passing around is the original version of the group, the poem that I photocopied, and we're all signing that, and we'll leave that here as a gift to Holden Village. I wanted to talk again briefly about the group poem. For those of you who aren't familiar with this exercise as a group journal process or activity, it can do, you can do a couple of different things. What we did was choose to focus on a topic, which was Railroad Creek. And then we all went out and achieved different locations along it. I think we all gravitated to whatever met our interests, our abilities to walk and see and so on. And this poem, I think, reflects some very interesting perspectives. I started with the overview, and then I switched to two or three comments I'm going to have from the mountain's perspective, or looking at the mountain, and then I switched to some water perspectives, and then the last is a longer poem. We were supposedly restricted to one line, and most people found that hard to do. One person contributed a longer version because she just couldn't stop, which I thought was just perfect.
You said one sentence, you didn't say one line.
Right, one sentence. Right. Thank you.
And a sentence can be awfully long. Right. Use semicolons.
Use colons and semicolons and dashes.
the six of you, each of you wrote one of these versions?
Actually, there were five of us, I think, and one person wrote, let's see, Esther, I put in both of yours, the rushing waters repeat, and what if the mountain could think? And I divided that up. So. And let's claim the mountain in its grandeur. Who wrote that? Okay. And what if the mountain could think was Esther's. Water, colon, I feel, is Mark's. The rushing waters repeat is Esther's again. Flowing water shapes, that's mine. And then the warmth of the sun, the sparkling water is... Did I skip your comment?
I didn't hear what you said.
Is that yours, the last paragraph?
The bottom one,
yes. I need to speak louder and more clearly. Thank you.
I guess I was really not paying attention.
Right? No. So, that particular group activity, I think, is a wonderful one. The other type of group poem that we talked about doing, and then we gravitated towards writing about a special topic like Railroad Creek, is to simply go out and focus in much more intimately, again from different perspectives. Our next activity was the haiku activity, or the cinquain, or the poetry sculpture. And I actually need to give these back and then collect them from. So pass these around to whoever these are. Do I have anybody else's? And those two? Okay. There's one more coming around here. Yeah. I have to find my own. Who would like, maybe we should go around in a circle. Would that be fair? You want to start with what you did yesterday?
I went and listened, observed, enjoyed, but achieved nothing.
Okay. Well, that's certainly not an unusual product. I actually had my eyes fall fairly solidly upon eyelids for just a few moments myself.
But I had thoughts that I had written down, and okay. So I can still pick it up sometime.
If you want to get it on our page, get it to me at breakfast tomorrow. I'm going to type it right after breakfast. And Mark, why don't you share and describe what you did?
Well, when we first went out, the first thing that we looked at, Mark helped us look at some mushrooms that are growing right by the power pole out here, and they're different than a lot of them, or any of them that we've seen so far, in my experience. And I thought those were really neat looking. They had these little cracks on the sides, and they started to drop their spores, and their spores are dark chocolate brown, and they're really quite lovely. And I know he's been taking photos of them. And I should say, as an aside right now, that yesterday after I went for my walk in there, I walked that direction, and I had noticed a couple times that they have changed the direction of the path because a big tree fell in there or something. And there's a part of the path that they're not using anymore. Well, I stepped over the branches that they had piled there to keep people from stepping over in that area, and walked on this old part of the path. And if you have a chance, you're walking there, there's some other kinds of funguses mm-hmm. that you may not have gotten some pictures of too. Kind of skirt around through the back, right in the middle of this building, kind of, and get to the back door of that old stump house.
Okay.
Well, I don't know whether that's fitted his plan or not, but I got fungus on the mind, I guess, and kind of divorced myself from the river in terms of the haiku. I have to tell you right off the bat at the outset here that I do not like haiku at all. And I do not like Senkane for some reasons that are just of no importance here at all.
But you didn't know that 3 days ago, right?
No, I think over a period of time as I have read, probably it comes from the kids' page in Natural History magazines, where they encourage kids to write haiku, and then they print them up, and right. they applaud them, and do all right. these kinds of things, and I think, that doesn't mean anything to me, and right. so I've come to not like it, and I hope nobody else will be influenced by that necessarily. But I had already made up my mind when I walked down there that I wasn't going to write any haiku. And I knew for sure poetry sculpture was out and Senkane was a lost cause. So I figured, well, I'm just going to pick a mushroom and draw a picture of it, which I did. And I got to the point where the clock said I was supposed to meet my wife up at the ice cream bar, and I left it. But last night I sat down then with my picture of the mushroom that I had drawn and finished it up, some details. I had taken some notes on where it was light and where it needed to be darker and things like that. And as I cross-hatched on there, I thought, I've just got to have some haiku.
I realized.
So I wrote a haiku, and amazingly enough, the first thing I thought of came out to be 5, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the second one came out to be about 12 or 14 by a little manipulation. I dropped it back to 7, and then the third one, 5, dropped into place pretty easily too. So it wasn't painful once I did it, it was just good.
For those of you new to the sessions, haiku has a 3-line requirement, 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables.
Right.
With an totally interaction right. between a natural object and ultimately yourself. It should attempt to combine the two elements. So would you read that?
I will read this. One word that may not be familiar, you may not be familiar with, is mycelium. The body of a fungus is made up of tiny thread-like things that grow inside of a tree or in the organic debris on the floor of the forest or wherever it's deriving its nutrition from. And that mass of white threads, it looks a lot like mold, is called the mycelium, or the mycelial body, or something like that. And I use that word in here. The mushroom that comes up above is equivalent to the apple that hangs on a tree. That's the fruiting body, and it's on that the spores are produced for reproduction. So the apple tree itself is the white mass that's under the ground. Mycelial mass, whiter than the driven snow, spores must be produced. And I pass it on. Take a quick snap of it.
Thank you for both of them.
Stay tuned.
Maybe we'll have Mark talk about his sketching, approach to sketching and drawing too in a minute. As we, after we finished. The key to drawing, of course, is to be something more than two-dimensional flatness. And we'll ask him about that. Let's see, Jean, would you share your writing?
Apples lay on the ground, becoming dry and wrinkled, growing old like us.
Dry and wrinkled, yes, that's me. That's good.
I'm going to come back to all of these in just a minute. Let's see.
Ferns turning golden along the mossy woodland trails bring thoughts of winter.
Mm-hmm. Good. And
here stands a large cedar. Here lies a small piece of bark. This, the world and me.
Mm-hmm. All right. I too wrote a haiku, and I think I predicted that it would be with the water was with. The water ouzel flies underwater, bursting out to splash. Which, and now that I'll use my own because it misses one of the goals of haiku slightly, and that is to evoke some human response or human moment. And we can go around. I heard in yours, Mark, the anthropomorphic or the humanness, the compulsion that to produce spores.
That, yes, and yet it doesn't really
touch
with the human moment.
But were you thinking that when you wrote that, or how did you think about that element?
I don't think I was thinking human mm-hmm. at the time, but I was thinking survival of that.
Okay.
Not that individual, certainly, but as a group,
right.
The spores must be produced. So one might make that intuitive leap, but I wasn't really.
And it's certainly possible, and the reader, as a listener or a reader, I certainly did. And that's ultimately a success then from the point of view of the reader. And
I could do that same thing though with your word splash.
Right.
Water ouzel comes out because, you know, that's that splash might not splash on me, but it's something that's happening to me.
And ultimately, from.
Can you speak just a little louder?
Yes. So in both cases, I felt in mine that I didn't quite achieve that human element. But I heard, when I read Marx, I felt a response, a chord inside me. The need to produce those spores is, his haiku evoked that in me. And that's ultimately a success. I think the other examples, and yours with the apples, read your last line again, would you?
The last line?
The last line. Or maybe read the whole thing.
Apples lay on the ground, becoming dry and wrinkled, growing old like us.
Okay, well, there's a very explicit and direct haiku.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, we're all born to relate to that emotion. And I like that very much. I think anyone who gets past, 21, starts to relate to that.
Somewhere there.
The other...
I thought I should have said me, because
no,
it's
not
of us.
No, no.
Us is fine.
Us, because you are the human...
Only one syllable. Right. Yeah, right.
You are the human race. And so I think us is, in fact, the correct choice there. And would you reread yours as well?
Ferns turning golden along the mossy woodland trail bring thoughts of winter.
Do you see again, bring thoughts of winter relating to the natural object, which is exactly the goal from the 16th century Japanese poets. It's supposed to combine in an either direct way, as you two have done, and yours as well, or somehow the reader is supposed to bring up an image connected with it. So again, I like that a lot. And the other aspect of both of those two, very appropriately, the original Japanese poets organized their haiku seasonally, quite often. If you look at the early... If you look at the books of haiku, you will very often see them organized along seasonal type of organization. Now that's redundant. Along seasonal elements or topics. And would you reread yours, please?
Here stands a large cedar. Here lies a small piece of bark. This, the world, and me.
Mm-hmm. Again, one of the natural elements of this is to go from the very specific object, as you've done with two elements, and build from those two what? What did you build? You built the world. Which, I mean, that's, you can't be more successful in imagery than that. Plus, the phrase, here lies the world and me, you evoke again for anyone, with the pronoun me, a very natural reader response. I like that as well. That's a good technique. So again, I feel like I slipped up a little bit in mine, but I find very successful efforts. I'm going to attempt to redo mine. I also, since I'm trying to lead this class, tried a... Remember the noun, two adjectives, three participles, mm-hmm. four nouns, three participles, two noun. I tried that. And I also tried the cinquain, so let me share those. So the first is the noun, two adjectives, etc. Water ouzel, black, small, dipping, splashing, swimming, bird, rocks, water, food, flying, singing, eating, quick, bright, water. And of course, for those of you who aren't familiar, that shape then becomes a diamond sculpture, or I would call a diamond shape. And you can see a thread running through all of mine here. They're all in the water. Who's the one? And this one, actually, I need a little help on. Remember, in the cinquain, you're supposed to start with the name of something. Mm-hmm. So I started with dipper, and then two words, small bird, three words, splashing, diving, eating, and then the phrase, flying in bright water, which I liked probably best of all of these. And then the last line, you're supposed to come up with a synonym for dipper, and water, I used water ouzel as my last line. And I'm not which is obviously that is the synonym.
Mm-hmm.
So dipper, small bird, splashing, diving, eating, flying in bright water, water ouzel.
And you're looking for three more words that would act as...
You actually don't need five words in the bottom line.
Oh, I see.
It's just to come up with a synonym for the very first word.
I see.
Read that cinquain again.
Mm-hmm. And let's remind ourselves of the requirements of this particular one, which is a noun, two adjectives, three participles, four nouns, three participles, two adjectives, and a noun. Water ouzel, black, small, dipping, splashing, swimming, bird, rocks, water, food, flying, singing, eating, quick, bright water. And I actually had more fun with that one than any of them.
You said we can use any geometric shape right. for that thing.
Well, ultimately, I think that's the freedom that poetry gives once you get away from the da-da, 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 or the A, B, A, B, mm-hmm. is that your shape, the way you type the words, the way you break your sentences, can come anywhere. And I think that's the freedom that you should treat your journals with, is get away from anything that binds, constrains you into to boxes. I really think that's what a journal should be, is a free place, some place to leap into. I found that one more interesting than the others. Partly because I got stuck on the haiku a little bit in terms of trying to get my human response, unless it's a little very subtle. But anyway, so those are some examples. I think I really, really like your haiku pieces as a group. They're very well done. I have a few more things that I wanted to share tonight. One is a portion of a letter from my father that I received the other day. Remember, we talked about me sending my letters to him as a journal. And then I wanted to read two examples from here. Did anyone else bring anything else you'd like to share tonight from your own journal?
I didn't bring something else. I just found something in a very short thing here that I thought would be.
All right. Did anyone else bring in anything else?
I have some things on illustration.
Oh, good.
If we have time.
Let's close with the illustration aspects, and we'll keep track of the time. Which piece did you find that you liked in here?
I think it's 183 Woodcrutch.
Joseph Woodcrutch.
183, The Voice of the Desert.
Mm-hmm.
By Joseph Woodcrutch. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 183, the future of mankind is dubious. Perhaps the future of the whole earth is only somewhat less dubious. But one knows that all does not depend upon man, that possibly even it does not depend upon this earth. Should man disappear, rabbits may well still run and flowers may still open. If this globe itself should perish, then it seems not unreasonable to suppose that what inspires the stem and the flower may exist somewhere else. And I, it seems, am at least part of all this. God looked upon the world and found that it was good. How great is the happiness of being able, even for a moment, to agree with Him.
All right.
And how much easier that is if one is not committed to considering only some one section of the world or of the universe.
Really excellent. I love the phrase, how great is the happiness of being able even for one moment to agree with.
Yes, I think that's kind of the important way.
There's a book of Crutch's that I strongly recommend to all of you if you enjoy the desert. It's called the My Desert Year or The Desert Year.
It's been years since I read that.
But it came out in the 50s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So look up Crutch, K-R-U-T-C-H, and it's either My Desert Year or The Desert Year. And he spent a year on sabbatical away from his English professorial duties, living in this adobe house in the desert and keeping a journal every day. And it became this marvelous book. It's now been republished with photographs, not many, but the original has these marvelous line drawings in it. So I encourage you to find in a library the original version of this book.
Would you give the title again?
It's either The Desert Year or My Desert Year. Crutch has become one of my favorite desert writers. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I'll never forget some of the things in that book about things like the desert tortoise, for example. How he describes this whole chapter on one animal, maybe a quail or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember specifics of it, but I just remember really enjoying his work.
Right. Another piece in here that I am going to cite as example brings out sensory details. And this is one of the things that, again, all of our writing could use more of all the time when you're in your journal. As I left on my hike this morning at 6 o'clock, I waited until I could hear the first birds sing. And probably the most impact of all from a sensory input was halfway up the trail, I hit this pocket of warm air. Now, why that should be in the valley up at 1,000 feet above the floor, I don't know, but those are the things that I constantly remind myself. What are the sensory feelings? And this comes from John Graves, who writes about a river that he calls the book Goodbye to a River. That morning I was up before dawn to blow away the ashes from the orange velvet embers underneath and to build more fire on them with twigs and leaves and brittle sticks of dead cottonwood. I huddled over it in the cold, still graying darkness, and watched coffee water seethe at the edges of a little charred pot licked by flame, and heard the horned owl stop that deceptively gentle five-noted comment he casts on the night. The geese at the island's head began to talk among themselves, then to call as they rose to go to pastures and peanut fields. A night-flushed bobwhite started whistling, "Where you? Where you?" to another somewhere above the steep dirt riverbank, drinking coffee with honey in it and canned milk, smoking a pipe that had the sweetness pipes only have in cold, quiet air. I felt good, if a little scratchy-eyed, having gone to sleep the night before. You see how many senses he's evoking there? Taste, hearing, scratchy-eyed, you can feel that. And on he goes, sound, the birds. I'm going to close with this because I don't want to go too much longer here because I want to hear Mark's contribution from on drawing. But Aldo Leopold grew up in a marvelous setting along the Mississippi River and wanted to be a forester. He went to Yale and then ended up down in the Southwest, thinking that if you killed off all of the cougars and that sort of thing, you'd have a better deer herd. Well, he went through an incredible transformation when they had this huge deer die-off from lack of predators, that maybe predators have a role. And he describes one of the moments that he wrote in his journals. He kept a journal all of his life, and unfortunately died very young. I now feel in his 40s. He would be about 80 years old right now. But it comes from the segment of the Sand County Almanac, which I highly, highly recommend if you haven't read a Sand County Almanac. It's truly one of the important pieces of literature in the United States. And in this Thinking Like a Mountain segment, he writes something that evokes much of my childhood. I grew up on a farm carrying a .22 rifle or a shotgun at a very early age. And we used it, you know. If it moved, sometimes you shot at it. And this evokes some of the transformation that I felt in my own life. In those days, and think back, this was when predators were still to be killed in his mind. In those days, we'd never heard of passing up a chance to kill a wolf. In a second after they had seen a mother wolf and six cubs, we were pumping lead into the pack, but with more excitement than accuracy. How to aim us down a steep hill is always confusing. When our rifles were empty, the old wolf was down and a pup was dragging a leg into impassable slide rocks. We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after the sea, I typed this in a letter to the editor, to every magazine I read that extols hunting in a kind of a bloodlust kind of way, killing animals. I personally think that hunting is not necessarily a bad thing, but to fill it with lust for killing, to fill it with a macho kind of attitude that is truly unnecessary. Or if you read about people killing and not eating, or killing unnecessarily, or killing for trophy. And some of the magazines even publish all the Leopold's words in response. That's just one of my little activities. But that phrase, but after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. Powerful words.
I remember the day that my husband came home from deer hunting with our young son. And he said, today we watched the deer, and we laid our guns down, and we knew from now on it would be cameras. Hmm. They just couldn't bring themselves to use the gun.
Yeah. I remember in my own limited army duty, it was shooting at human silhouettes that changed my mind about it. For me. Those kinds of things are very important to us as individuals. And again, journal entries, important ways to remember that, maybe for your son or your children, something to think back about. My father barely got a high school education, probably wrote 10 letters for 50 years, or 40 years. And then, of course, we all moved away. And he writes in quite a scrawl, so he finally learned to pick out one stiff finger at a time on a now electric typewriter. Letters to us, and I wanted to share with you again his grammar and his spelling and his punctuation. His structure is awful. If I were to judge that, it reminds me a little bit of Lewis and Clark's spelling, and in fact in their journals. But that's my father, and I love every word that he says, but I want to share with you a moment from a week ago when he walked out of the house early in the morning. It is a beautiful day, partly cloudy now after a heavy fog this early morning, 46 degrees and wind only a breeze, soft and pleasant. Most of the cornfields are now yellow with a hint of green still in the top half of the stalk and leaves. The corn ears have turned almost completely and hanging down in the drying position, nearly ready for the harvest. The pastures and hayfields have put on the ripe brown coloring, showing signs of going into the rest period of winter. The ditches that were mown and baled still show the delicate green color adopting various stages of autumn, reminding me of many pheasant hunting trips. Some fields are tilled and show only a few signs of the vegetation tilled under. Others are so neat and trim with the lines of drill marks and the fall seeding of rye and winter wheat are complete. Now and then there is the new growth showing sparse in each drill tract with the hint of green of new growth, a promise of the harvest of next year. We are catching a northern visitor at our bird feeder and bird bath. Some of the early travelers are coming by. They prefer the cedars as they are used to the pines. Their interesting colors show up so clearly, for all our native birds have all but disappeared. About a brown thrush, a few robins, the mourning doves have become so gun-shy, now they do not stay but a brief moment anywhere in sight. Seem to be preoccupied with preparations for their trips out. Sometimes we are overrun almost by the sparrows, but soon they find other interests and leave the yard. It's very interesting and surprising to hear the call of a meadowlark, for it's so seldom they sing now, but a few are here. I was pleasantly surprised by a covey of partridges right next to our driveway early yesterday morning. They exploded up and the whir of their wings sound for a time until they're lost in the distance. The happiness of their presence lingers with me as I began my walk. Often the distance is that special call of a pheasant rooster. Again I am surprised. In the distance I hear the second rooster. The numbers do seem to be increasing. They just don't have a hunting season for a year or two to give them a greater chance.
This sounds pretty poetic to me.
I mean, incredibly descriptive. And what I'm saying, I guess, to all of us is that he never gave himself a chance. He never wrote anything down. He never wrote letters. And in fact, as good Midwestern Scandinavians, we hardly ever talked. Yeah, we would go for long walks or these hunting trips together. The pheasant hunting was a big childhood experience for me. So what I want to use him as an example is it's not too late, it's never too late, and it's creates power in yourself, it creates power in your words, and this is a gift to me. I really treasure that. You can do it too. To your friends, to your family. So try journal writing, try letter writing, whatever you want to call it. So thank you for sharing this time with me. And Mark, let's hear from you about
Okay. Thanks for sharing that letter with us. Appreciate that. What I have to say about illustration stems from, first of all, the idea that I have that although somebody else might read my bird journal sometime, or sometime I might share something from my bird journal with somebody who's gathering data and wants to know what the first day of this year I have seen a varied thrush in our area or something like that. Primarily my bird journal is written for myself, and it's a little bit like some of this material. I'm not writing it it's on the other side here. I don't write in order to be understood by others, but rather I write to understand some people who keep journals, some birders, that's my experience, I guess I should specify that. Some birders who keep journals simply list what they see and what the date was. That's it, they're listers. Mm-hmm. And some people get pretty serious about that. They'll, you know, put their vacation around that and everything else, travel miles and miles and miles and miles to do that, but they simply list. Once they have it on the list, if that bird is still there, they don't look at that bird, you know. And I can't agree with that method of observation. to me, the journal is a place for me to write down not only the bird's name, but something about my observations of the bird, particularly behavioral observations. What is that bird doing? And maybe possibly some interpretation, but not necessarily. So birds are hard to illustrate. They're really not very easy to illustrate at all. I've tried a few.
Drawing
of birds, yes. I mean, there are many very good illustrators of birds, but I don't happen to be one. And maybe that'll come someday. So often enough, what I do use as illustrations are the setting or something, you know, about where the bird is rather than the bird itself. There is a place in Western Washington in the big bay between March Point, where all the refineries are next to Anacortes, and an area which is kind of farmland north of the Skagit Flats, northwest of Mount Vernon, and that area where they grow tulips and all kinds of flowers and bulbs, and it's the big seed producing area in our area. I think every cabbage seed in the world that's ever sold is grown right in that spot. Anyway, this Padilla Bay is a very shallow bay, and when the tide goes out, it becomes a mucky old, awful place, you know, for most people. But it's estuary, and that means it's a mix of the fresh water running off from the land and the salt water that's coming in to meet it. And as such, it's biologically one of the most diverse and very rich areas in all of the state. And is a very important place for birds on migratory pathways to stop and feed and gain their strength and put on some fat and move on, you know, especially during the spring and the fall. Well, there was a lady who was an English teacher in Seattle for a long time, I understand, Brazil by name, I think, who lived there with her brother, or two brothers, who farmed on the side of Padilla Bay. And when the brothers were gone, she made up her mind that that farm was going to be used by people, you know, the public, and so there has formed there, under the auspices of NOAA and several other agencies, the Padilla Bay Brazil Interpretive Center, National Estuary and something. It's got quite a number of titles, something like that. And they give classes there, and they have a library there, and they have aquariums and a museum and a number of things. And they regularly have various kinds of classes like photography, such as you gave, and so on the weekends. And there's a person who works there regularly whose name is Elizabeth Mills, or Libby Mills in our area. She's an artist and teaches a variety of classes. She makes her living designing natural designs on shirts and so on, and having them printed and selling them. And she works for the Nature Conservancy at the Skagit River Eagle wintering over area. And she offered a class that Rosemary and I took one time, and it was just a short class. It was about illustrating your journals. And what I have to say here is what I can remember from that class, and I've simulated some of the exercises she put us through. She showed us some of her journals, and I reacted the same as you react to your friend's journals. They are really quite beautiful. They're very nice to look at, and I'm not sure my journals will ever look that way, but her encouragement was to go ahead and illustrate anyway. It's for yourself. You know, it's to gain understanding. Not to have other people understand you, but to gain understanding for yourself. And she put us through several paces to ease the transition. One of the things she said was, try to draw or sketch something every day for a while, simply because it takes a while for you to learn what happens to a piece of paper when you put a piece of pencil on it and wiggle the pencil. Just the feel of what goes on there at the tip of your lid, you know, as you're moving it around down there. And I have to admit, I haven't done that. But when I do it for a while, I'm more satisfied than when I don't do it. And I can see changes in a very short period of time when I start doing that. Well, the first exercise she had us do was one I thought was really crazy. She stood us up there in the parking lot and she said, or off on the grass next to the place, and she said, now I want you to look off in the distance someplace, and I want you to take what you're gonna draw on and your pencil and get yourself started and look up at what you're gonna draw and draw the whole thing without ever looking down. And she, I don't know that she ever said, don't lift the pencil off the paper, but that was good advice, you know, you get lost, you don't know where to go back to. And of course, when you look at it, it's really a genuine scribble. Well, I tried this again from the deck over here at the ice cream shop, looking off this direction, and if you'll just pass it quickly up and down here, you'll see that it is a scribble, but it has, if you squint your eyes and hold it out at arm's length, some semblance of what that thing looks like. And of course, what she's trying to do is to get your eyeball and your arm and finally your wrist and your pencil kind of hooked together. And didn't she recommend that you do that?
Yeah, I think she
did. Over several times.
Not always, the whole landscape, but just one tree or something. Yeah. Of course, you get a great big tree on this side, a little tiny tree on this side.
Mine wouldn't look like that.
But it's just an exercise in that eye-hand coordination. By the way, there are several, at least one, and probably a couple of others. They are a field sketching by Leslie and Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, and I see Betty Edwards has another one. Another book that is right. Perhaps a sequel to that
it
one.
Is.
So there are some references that that her professor has given us already that I would recommend to you for reading if you get at all serious about doing that kind of thing. Then she asked us to pick something out. She said, you have 2 minutes to go and find something and bring it back. I want you to draw it. And she recommended a leaf or the seed head off of a weed or something like that. She says, don't make it a big deal, just something small and bring it back and try to draw it. Well, I've tried to draw a little cone, and I found out later it was a cone of a western larch. As she recommended, first of all, try to draw the shape of the thing and then begin to fill in the detail little by little by little. And then if at first you just want the outlines, that's fine, and then later on, maybe on a part of it, you can add some cross-hatchings or some little striations or little stripes or a little shading and that sort of thing, that's fine too. But at first she said, just the shape of the thing was fine.
The outline.
Just the outline is what I'm saying, right. Yeah. And so you can take a quick squint at this picture of a large cone that I've drawn, and spend a considerable time with that one. And since I'm just simulating the exercises, I don't really think very highly of that picture, and yet I was learning something about what happens when the tip of the pencil hits the paper and you wiggle it around a little bit, because it feels a certain way, and you've got to learn something about that feel before you'll get really what you're satisfied with. She had us do that in 2 or 3 times, and then also recommended that if you really want to, you can have the watercolors or little stubs of color pencils or something. And I picked up a leaf over here and went over to school and borrowed a box of their colored pencils one day and attempted to add some color to a leaf. And that's kind of fun, because you can mix, if you have a simple 12 pencil set of colors, you can mix and go over and erase and mix and put them together. And that makes it a little more than just black and white, and helps you to gain some shape, some three-dimensionality to it, rather than just width and height, you know, just flat 2 dimensions. You can add some of that kind of stuff.
Do you have a preference to the kind of a pencil you use?
I just use a number two pencil, although Libby recommended these new kinds of pencils that, you know, with the tiny lead in them. She said a lot of people are starting to use those because this soon wears round and fat and blunt, you know, and then unless you've got a smooth rock to shine it up on or something. But with those little, they're always, what is it, 0.5 millimeters in diameter, no matter how many times you punch it, you know. And some of those have smaller lead than that, so.
No, what would you comment on that, Rosemary, when she says the kind of pencil?
Oh, I'd like to have a variety. Or remember I said I'd always like to have a very sharp pencil as well as one that you can use bluntly or smudge with your fingers so that you can have a variety of sharp and dull, you know, textures, different textures. Quick, tell them about the stump. That's lots of fun.
Okay. I like at this point, what I have left here in my hand are simply practice sketches of other kinds of things that might be the kinds of things you do for daily sketching. Included in them are a picture like the first one I showed you, except this time you can look and draw and look and draw and look and draw. You're not confined to drawing without looking. But as I pass those around, I want to tell you about a book that I mentioned before. It's called Acclimatization, and it's by a man whose name is Stephen Van Matry. Stephen Van Matry worked with youth camps in the eastern part of the United States, and he felt, as I have come to feel, that too often when we go places and experience places, we keep our eyes on the trail because we're afraid of tripping, or we keep our eyes this way and our perspective is largely limited. And this relates to the illustration business. And so he invented several different kinds of things he could do with kids, including, I think he had some bosun's chairs that were strung to high trees, and he would put kids in those and haul them way up in the trees someplace and let them experience what the forest was like from up there down instead of being down here just looking outward this way. Mm-hmm. Or they had the swamp stomp day where he told them to wear old tennis shoes and their worst looking clothes, and they'd go and get into the muck and mud of a swampy end of the lake, and they really experienced it, you know. The one that I thought was neatest to do because it was easiest on a nature trip, and anybody can do it even for themselves, is where he took them out and he said, all right, now find a spot like we did the other day. And he says, now this time, instead of just looking around you, lay down on your back and look straight up. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't remember exactly what the sequence was, but he said, then find something as you're looking straight up that you really kind of like, and then pretend you're going to take a picture of it and put a frame around it and begin to look at that very specific spot and look at its shapes, first of all, and then textures and colors and so on. And to me, his efforts at getting people to look at their surroundings from different perspectives is worthwhile in terms of, as you write in your journals, to also illustrate them, maybe from different perspectives. I was reminded of this the other day when we talked about speaking about the river from the viewpoint of the water, or speaking of this the tree from being inside of the tree looking out. Some things you just can't do, of course. You have to do that in your imagination, but Stephen Van Matry provides us some things that we can do. Now, an exercise, you might try an illustration in your journal called a stump drawing. And I'm not sure this is from Stephen Van Matry, but it's used in Girl Scouts and Campfire Girls a lot, where they take a group of kids out and they find a stump or a tree that's experienced a fire. And so they draw the picture of the stump or the tree or that area, and then they take a chunk of charcoal off of the stump and they use that for shading
You know, they don't take charcoal along with them, but they take the burned piece of the stone and use that for color.
That's a good idea.
And then they can take a salal leaf, for example, and crush it a little bit and get some green color out of it. And so they draw some of the branches moss. And color moss. The leaves. Or mosses, you can get different kinds of colors of yellow and brown and all that kind of stuff.
Dirt.
Yeah, you can use the
and
dirt.
And some kinds of brown stuff, the gooey brown stuff sometimes that you get out of a stump.
So, and you know what you've got is more than just a sketch or an illustration. You've got kind of a part of it when you take that one home. And it's not that it won't ever fade or change color or anything like that, but it's a really very much more real.
I like that idea a lot.
Oh, the Girl Scouts love it.
Let me throw in one more detail. I've forgotten this, but it was the breakthrough for me in drawing, my friend Bill Anderson, who did the painting part of my summer workshops that I did the photography side, he started us on shapes, and he said that's the key thing. And what he said recommended you do with shapes is, for practice the first time, is to just look at a rock or a bowl like that, preferably a natural object, and just draw the shape without, and don't pick up. And don't look, and never pick it up. And it's amazing how close you come sometimes.
Even if it has a little abstract character or something, it's there.
And then the next step, which has boggled my mind, I could never, ever accomplish shading. And so on. And he said, what you have to think about is that each shading or each separate color of gray, if it's in black and white, or each color tone is actually nothing but another shape. And what you can do is sketch in the shape of that color first and the other colors, and then you go back and shade whatever tones you want. That solved everything for me. For the first
margins
time,
of shapes.
Margins of color, of tones. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if we just were to look at this room, up there, and use that abstract light up there, and the various, each tone quality actually is a shape of light, of different tones, of different colors. And that helped me enormously, though it is his style of drawing. So each of us pick a realistic goal for the next 2 months, the next 6 months, the next year. Remember we talked about learning one plant a day or one plant a week for the next year or something like that? Well, try to do writing in your journal once a week, or once a day, whatever it takes, for the next 6 months, for the next 2 months, depending on your life circumstances. Try to do some efforts that involve commitment to just a little bit. What these 2 weeks have done for me is a recommitment to writing some letters that matter, rather than those that just recount my life, kind of a logbook kind of letter. I've fallen back into that.
I really appreciated your comment on, you know, writing to somebody saying save my letters, because I thought I cannot journal and I cannot write to my family while I'm here. There aren't enough hours in the day. So I started out immediately. I write to one child a day. You know, please save my letter, because this is my journal.
Yeah.
Good. So thank you.
Well, thank you for this week. I think I got more out of it than you. I need to collect your example.
Oh, thank you.